This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, coming at you, you know, a little bit bug-bitten, because I just got back from Mexico and got bit by three different kinds of things. Those little sand fleas, not the kind you use for fishing bait. Not little ghost crabs, which some people call sand fleas. Bit by those, bit by regular old mosquitoes, and also bit by no-see-ums.
Hey.
At dusk, sons of bitches come for you.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been prepared because...
Dude, I brought down 40% DEET. I'd put it on my kids' legs, and as soon as they went to bed, I'd give them a shower because I'm a little bit paranoid about DEET.
Yeah.
Rightfully so, since it'll warp your phone, as I found. If you spill if you spill this insect repellent on your phone, it'll warp your phone. So imagine what it does to your parts, you know, your skin cells.
Yeah.
Coming at you partially bug bitten and definitely from the banks of the Mississippi. There's a writer named Ben Metcalf. I don't know if he writes anymore or not. He used to write pieces for Harper's and was also an editor somewhere. Can't remember who he worked for. But he wrote, and some of his work would be collected at Harper's. And this guy, Ben Metcalf, wrote a piece called American Heartworm. And it was about the Mississippi. So as much as Mark Twain would celebrate the Mississippi, Ben Metcalf loathed the Mississippi River. One of his criticisms, for a lot of reasons. One, that he feels that any self-respecting river should be able to handle some amount of water without spilling out of its banks. And he didn't like it for that reason. Another thing is he feels that it's also the Mississippi is a con man and stole its place in the American lexicon because... By any reasonable measure, by any understanding of hydrology, the Mississippi isn't the Mississippi. The Mississippi is the Missouri. The Missouri is the great continent drainer. I mean, it heads in Three Forks, Montana, Three Forks is the confluence of the Madison, Gallatin, and Jefferson. So it's like the secretary of, at the time of the Lewis and Clark expedition, you had Madison, Secretary of State.
That's over my head.
Jefferson. And they named it after those three fellers.
Okay.
And all political figures at the time. They all head together. They come together at Three Forks and form in the Missouri. And then that thing flows thousands of miles and picks up a little shittin' tributary called the Mississippi and thereby changes its name when all it's doing is just like picking up a minor tributary dwarfed by like not nearly what the Ohio is when it picks it up. Mm-hmm. It should be called the Missouri River, who has this little known tributary called the Mississippi. This is Ben Metcalf's argument.
Because where it empties, not where it begins.
It's because people saw it and didn't really until later fully comprehend like what that watershed was, that it was one of the great.
Do you know if at the confluence, if the which one is greater, like which one has a?
Oh, when they come together,
yeah,
the Missouri's carrying more water. And the Missouri's been cranking along for. The Mississippi heads like
Lake Itasca.
North central Minnesota.
So how far from here? Not as far away as western Montana.
No, not even close.
The river's a con man. Yanni wanted to talk about that.
This quick little thing that I found on it, it just says the it was named after the president and two of his cabinet members, but it doesn't say...
Jefferson was the president.
Yeah, but it doesn't...
Louisiana Purchase. Old Tommy Jefferson. Yeah.
But it doesn't say, you know, what positions they held in the cabinet.
It was like treasurer and secretary or something like that. Easy to find out. So easy to find out. It's staggering that Yanni hasn't found out yet. Giannis, to recap something we were talking about, you've been messing around with sous vide cooking.
Mm-hmm.
You just did some shanks in your sous vide machine.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
For 48 hours, I cooked them.
At what temperature?
160. Hmm.
That's hot for sous vide.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it is. On the hotter side. I don't think you... I've done two different recipes now, so I'm definitely still figuring out. And from what I've been reading online, I think there's still a lot of figuring out. I think one of the pluses or, you know, pitching points of sous vide is that you have this great window that the meat is done and but won't be overdone.
You mind explaining to folks what we're talking about? I think the bulk of them might know.
Ooh.
My brother just last night texted me wondering if I knew what a banh mi sandwich was.
Oh.
I've been eating those things for
Those are tasty.
Long time. So here's a guy
there's
that didn't know a banh
mi. On a website called chefsteps.com, which is a sous vide recipe website.
That's the sous vide machine I have.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. They have a squirrel banh mi recipe made with sous vide squirrel meat.
There you go.
Yeah. But
my bro made banh mi with pate that he made from some game livers, deer liver and something else he put in
there. I would bet you there's no way we could find out, but that it might not be the bulk of our listeners would know what sous vide is.
I'm guessing.
I would take that bet.
Okay.
That it could be 50.
I wouldn't take the bet.
You wouldn't?
You're saying that of the mugs listening right now, less than half are familiar with sous vide.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that that's a high probability. High enough where I would take the bet.
Sure. Break it down.
But sous vide cooking basically.
Hold on. Let me do this. Pat, you know what sous vide is?
I was just going to say, I don't know.
Mr. Dern?
Don't look at me, man. I'm learning.
So half of this room.
And they actually count as listeners. I really don't.
That's true. It's a good
point. But you basically, it's cooking in water. And so that you're cooking meat in water. Actually, you cook anything. There's vegetable recipes. There's fish recipes.
Egg recipes.
But so that you don't... basically boil your meat and get it all soggy, you put it into a sealed plastic bag. Now, you can just use a regular old Ziploc, or if you have a vacuum sealer, you can go that route. The way that the whole system's set up is usually just use like a large stock pot, maybe a 2 or 3 gallon stock pot, and then there's a machine that looks like a, it's wand-shaped, I guess. And basically half of it plunges down into the water, and it regulates the temperature of the water. And I don't know what the lowest and highest settings are, but you basically just set that and it keeps it at a perfect temp that you want to keep it at for however long you want to do it.
Yeah, if you're cooking, let's say you're cooking a roast and you want to pull the roast at for rare, you know, you want to pull your venison roast. Let's say I like to pull it at 130
mm-hmm.
or 125. Well, the oven's 400 degrees.
Yeah.
Right. So this thing's climbing to eventually reach that, and you're intercepting it at that point where you want to nab it out.
And then you
set the water at the final temperature.
Yeah. Add to the complication of that setup is that you pull it at one temp, knowing that it's going to continue to rise to your goal temperature.
Because the outer heat is going to continue to penetrate into the inside.
Right.
So this, you just set it at what you want it to end up at.
Exactly.
So if you're cooking, if you know that you like your salmon, say, at blank temp, you just set your water bath at that temp, drop into your bag.
Yeah. So, if you think about it, if you set it at 160, the meat never gets above 160. But what does happen is that there is a breaking down of, proteins, obviously, because I cooked my shanks for 48 hours and...
48 hours. That's the thing.
But again, the recipe was 24 to 48.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we could have eaten it Saturday night. Instead, we ate it Sunday night.
It's perfect on Tuesday and perfect on Wednesday.
Because it's just keeping it at that temperature that whole time.
Yeah.
It's so holding it at like a safe
temperature's not rising, which I think when you're going for like a medium rare steak is important. But in this case of these shanks, it's obviously continuing to break it down. Which is, I think, where it might get a little bit trickier. The window might not be as great when you are working with a piece of meat that you want to eat at medium rare, because medium rare, or whatever, 130 degrees after 6 hours is going to be different than 130 degrees after 10 hours.
Oh, yeah. I kind of exaggerate about done on Tuesday and done on Wednesday. Same temperature on Tuesday, same temperature on Wednesday, but it has the effect of you can screw it up. Yeah. You can screw it up.
I don't know exactly how yet. I'll know more. I'm going to keep messing around with it. But
well, I know how. Like things that I've screwed up is I've found that when it comes to cooking wild game, for me personally, I don't like to use the sous vide for like lean roasts that don't have a lot of connective tissue on them, such as like if you were to take a whitetail deer and take the sirloin or round roast off the back leg, I can get a better effect. I can get a better product in my oven than I can get with my sous vide, because it gives it to my taste, it gives it a sort of pastiness. Where I think it really shines is when it comes down to cooking things, it's an easy, pretty fail-safe way to cook cuts that are best cooked, slow cook strategy.
I get you.
Like, I've taken one of the things I made that I liked most with sous vide was I took one time a javelina, front leg of a javelina, which is a rascally little hunk of meat.
It just sounds tough.
Yeah. You can pull those strands out and floss your teeth with them. Okay. But in that thing, I think I gave it like 36 hours. And then it just is like you could just pick it apart with your fingers and it's silky and beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, what I did is kind of toss those, picked all that meat, kind of toss them with oil, and then stuck them under a broiler for a minute. Because the thing with sous vide cooking is you're oftentimes getting it just right, but what you get used to, and I remember one time a chef, like I reading about the chef who wanted to quit being a chef, and he says, well, I just got bored with it. Making things soft on the inside and crispy on the outside. It just got old to me. But like when you do a roast in your oven, like one of the nice things about it is you get that finished outside.
Yeah.
You know, like crispy browned outside, and you cut in it, and lo and behold, there's like this magical red middle, and just like the whole thing together, all the parts are bigger than any individual part.
And that texture, that meat of a nice roast like that, the texture of the meat is a part of it. And if the other way of cooking is breaking that down, then I see where you're.
Yeah, because you wind up with the whole beauty of it, like the crispy outside, the red inside. It's like it's all nice together.
Yeah.
So what? A part of sous vide cooking, like most sous vide preparations, you'll find that you're going to get it perfect and then sear it after the fact. Whereas if I'm cooking a roast in my oven, I sear it and finish in my oven. Here, you're often like a lot of, if you look at a sous vide, a lot of preparations, you're starting it. You know, you get it all done. It's ready to go. Then you take that thing out and sear it. Or people even finish them with like a torch apparatus.
Yeah.
Right, like you might like people to do like sous vide scallops and then take a torch and sear the scallop with a torch.
Yeah, and really control that then.
You know, so it's real sciencey cooking, but as good as it is for some stuff, I don't think it's like perfect. It's not like perfect for everything.
No, I don't think all of a sudden I'm just going to start having just like...
Get rid of your oven.
And five buckets in the kitchen, and one says Monday, and then Tuesday, Wednesday.
But I'll tell you what's cool, though, is you could take a couple, let's say, because you did shanks, right? How'd they turn out?
Great. So I did a sick-a-deer shank, the whole shank, in a bag. It had a whitetail shank. And then I had one bag, I think, that had three or four of those. Again, do you know the name of that little, it's like a shank, but, you know, it's not connected to the bone. It's connected to that.
Yeah.
The big tendon.
Don't know the name of it.
That goes up on the hind leg. No. You kind of get that big shank-like piece, right? Yep. That has all that same sinew and collagen and stuff running through it. And the ones on the bone were just delightful. Just silky, smooth, wonderful flavor, and no dryness at all about them. The antelope little football tendon chunks I just described, there's still a touch of dryness. And it wasn't the sous vide's fault. It's just the cut of the
nature
meat.
Of the meat.
It just didn't have as much fat, connective tissue, whatever it is, as the shanks that were on the bone.
Yeah. That's kind of like the sort of the thing with all forms of cooking is not all hunks of meat are made equal.
No.
If you went to make, if you took some like sirloin meat and went and did a shank preparation for it, it's going to be miserable. But there's something about those pieces that have all that collagen or stuff that breaks connective tissue, silver skin, tendons that break down into that just like silky beautiness.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Well, to say the nice thing about it is if, let's say you're having some folks over for dinner, you could bag out servings, stick them in that thing, and you don't know you're eating at 5 o'clock or 8 o'clock. Right.
Yeah.
You could bag out servings, stick them in that thing the day, a day and a half before, 2 days before, a day before, whatever, for your particular preparation, knowing that at the second you want to reach in there and cut those bags open, it's all ready. Because you're not just like putting, you know, you're putting all the ingredients in there. You can, you know what I'm saying?
Of the meal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, you know, if you're doing shanks, you're putting all the ossobuco, all the things that would traditionally go into ossobuco in that bag and sealing that bag up and putting them in there.
What I'd like to mess around with a little bit is like I was thinking about maybe putting like a couple sprigs of thyme in there, sprig of rosemary,
that's what I did.
Some butter, you know, maybe trying to wonder if it'll impart that flavor.
Oh, yeah. No, I feel, cooking. Yeah, I packed that bag full of good things to eat, even, you know, doing something like the javelina shank. But yeah, I just like, for me though, cooking those like loin and like quality roasts,
yeah,
it's like I get such, what I get out of my oven cannot be beat.
Yeah So cannot for you it's beat. More of a replacement for basically braising. Yep. Technique.
It's a nice fail safe, time friendly. It takes a lot of time to do it, but it's good preparation.
And when you said that you're putting all kinds of good, so you're like putting vegetables and all kinds of things in with it? Or?
Sure, you can, knowing that the vegetables are going to be
a little mushy.
Because, like, you know, everything has its own cooking time.
Right.
But I mean, there's like, it's becoming such a popular thing now that there's no short, you can go find recipes for anything. Like,
sure.
If you buy a sous vide device, it's going to come with a book. And you realize that every damn thing you've ever eaten. Now, one thing, Steve Kendrot,
mm-hmm.
he's been doing salmon. Like I gave him some salmon from the fish shack. He's doing salmon in his sous vide and loving it.
Really?
That dude's a sous vide fool now. He knows about it.
The timing different
I'm
on
calling
that?
Steve.
He damn sure knows about it. He likes it. I sent him some vacuum bags, and he was more fired up about sous videing with them than he was about freezing them.
Speaking of Steve, I was also telling you that I made his fennel sausage recipe, which it's so good. It might be so good because it is so simple, but literally all it is fat, salt, pepper, and fennel.
Well, meat.
Yeah.
So you got your buck. Yeah, you got your buck meat. Then you cut some fat in.
Yeah, a lot of fat. It's his recipe was 50-50.
That's a bit much. And I had the sausage. It's phenomenal, but I think it's like
yeah,
a what?
But I wanted, the first time I wanted to do it, I want to follow the recipe.
Sure.
Because I feel like you should, and then you can tweak it because you just never know otherwise. So next time I probably will cut it back to 40, maybe even 30.
Yeah, and my thinking, it goes beyond it's like what tastes good. 50-50, at some point it ceases to be a wild game dish.
That's true.
At some point it's like a hybrid. It's all a hybrid. Like my brother used to be like a real purist and he wouldn't put any domestic fat in his game meat. He would just, if he was making burgers, he'd crack an egg in there. So
which
he could
one?
Hold, Danny. He'd crack an egg in there so he could make it hold together in a patty.
Yeah.
That's extreme. I think 50% is extreme. I find my personal comfort zone in the 10 to 20% fat.
Yeah, but I feel like to me, sausage, it can't be sausage if it's not like greasy enough. There's got to be some grease left in the pan, because otherwise I feel like you're just eating this like thing that kind of tastes like sausage because the flavor's there, but something is just not sausage-like because you've taken too much fat out.
Okay, then let's come up with a different word for it. Meat sticks. No, that's not right. I get what you're saying.
Sausage-flavored dry meat. Ground, dry, ground meat.
Sausage-flavored dry meat. I'm cool with that. But no, his sausages were good.
But anyways, yeah, back to it. And the recipe came out wonderful. I mean, it's just so simple. Fennel. I mean, it's all you're like tasting in salt and pepper, and it's wonderful.
Does he toast his fennel first?
I don't know if the recipe didn't call for it.
That's a good trick, man. When you're making sausage, like sweet Italian, any kind of sausage, you're putting fennel in there. Take all your seeds and toast them.
Right.
And what does that do?
Smells your whole house up like fennel. Smells good, man. I don't know if it then goes away, but it's just like really like pleasing. If you toast them and you get them all warm, like coriander, fennel, whatever, you put them in a pan over a burner, just a dry pan over a burner, and kind of shake it, and they'll kind of let off like a oil.
Yeah.
And they'll get very fragrant. Then you throw those, but if they're still warm, you throw those in your coffee grinder if you're pulverizing them a little bit. Then you really got something that smells nice.
I think it's got to add to the flavor, because there's a lot of dishes, like when you're cooking Indian food, a lot of times like you've sautéed your onions and maybe a couple of the other things that you're sautéing like that in the oil that might take 5 or 10 minutes. And before you add like, let's just say if it's curry, before you add the coconut milk and your carrots and peas and chicken or whatever it might be, when you throw the spices in, you let them kind of cook and toast in that pan for a couple minutes to, you know, release extra flavor. And then you add in the rest of the ingredients. So I'm sure it works the same for that fennel.
Yeah. The next thing I'm going to sous vide, and this is the last we'll talk about it. I still have two big ass yellow eye fillets that I've been eyeballing in my freezer, and I want to get to them pretty quick. They last a lot longer than salmon in the freezer because they're not that fatty. But I'm going to do those guys with my sous vide machine. I used to have a giant sous vide machine that came with like what looked like you could wash a child in the tub. But I gave it to my buddy Pooter because now I got that smaller one. Pat, Durkin, Doug Duren, the cousins.
Durkin and Duren.
The Durkin and Duren cousins. Pat. Okay. It doesn't really matter what you say because it's not going to change my mind. Tell me about your opinions on, your findings on, wound loss.
I was going to say, before I even said what you said, I was going to say, I know no matter what I say right now, I probably won't change your mind.
And, well, you were going to preface it with
that. Yeah, I was going to be my preface. I'll start by saying, one article I've always liked the way I handled it was I broke it down one time in our Wisconsin gun season to show that our peak deer season was the year 2000, where we killed like over 400,000 deer.
In Wisconsin.
And we basically, if I broke it down to show that we were killing about 1.4 deer per second during that 9-day gun season, when you break it over the course of a 9-day season. And then I started calculating, I started looking into it, to kill 1.4 deer a second.
Oh, come on, man. So, all right. Did you ever figure it out like on opening day?
No, see, that's
100%.
I actually did that, but I don't have that at the tip of my tongue, though. I actually did break it down by opening weekend and then opening day and then the rest of the season. I had this whole article on this whole topic.
So, but real quick, on opening day, of the 400,000 that got killed in the season, can you guess how many got killed on opening weekend?
Yeah, typically opening weekend, I think they figure close to 65-70% gets killed opening weekend. Then it just kind of goes down, peaks back up around Thanksgiving, because we always have our season around, starts the weekend before Thanksgiving, that ends the Sunday after Thanksgiving.
How big was the deer herd this year, the year you're talking about?
That was like an all-time record number. So I think they calculated 1.5 million deer or so, 1.6 million deer they estimated in that population.
And they were able to pull a harvest of 400,000 out of
it. Yeah, it was even more than 400,000.
And that was at the time regarded as like wildly too many deer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I think realistic people thought that was too many deer. We had too many deer. And
too many deer on the ground, not getting killed, but too many deer alive.
But then you go into what hunters want, though, and there was a lot of hunters that year. That was a pretty mediocre to average season. You know, so you always get those arguments.
You people are never happy.
Never happy. As I said, so the last time we talked, deer make people stupid. You know, just the way it is. But to continue my discussion, though, is I got curious about that. If we're shooting that many deer, you know, deer per second, and I think last season was 0.62 deer per second in the last gun season, 2017.
2017 was 0.62 deer, so 0.6 deer per second.
Right.
And in 2000, it was
more than double that.
Okay.
Yeah. Averaged out over the course of 9 days.
Yeah.
During hunting hours. I just was doing some math there.
Right. During,
I was like, wait a minute.
Exactly.
I broke it
down by hours of shooting light, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
And then what was fun then was I took those kind of numbers and started digging into the research I could find on how many shots get fired for each deer killed. And there actually is, you know, some research around Wisconsin from the 70s, and there's research from South Carolina in like 1999, that time period. Ontario did this one time. But basically, Wisconsin back in the 1970s, and some of the research they did was averaging between 3.5 and 7 shots per deer taken was about what was coming at.
What?
Yeah. This is in one area. This is never one of these qualifiers where I'll never convince you, because it's most studies are taking place in controlled settings, because you can't just go out in the landscape with all the variables and get anything interesting. And so anyway, so you had this variability because they had different kind of seasons. They set up one season where it was antlerless only, so the guy had to be more careful when you shot that you weren't shooting a buck. So that kind of cuts down how many shots are being fired. Then if you have a wide open season where anything's legal, they're shooting a lot. They shot like almost twice as many shots in those kind of seasons. But then I looked at, I found this research from South Carolina, looked into that, and they were shooting only 1.2 times for each deer they killed. And those guys, though, were setting up on basically a shooting house, rifle rest, nice setups where they're touching out the shots like a real precision type shooting. And then you had other scenarios. So none of these things are all equal. You know, I'm getting that here.
Yeah.
So what I finally did was I had like...
So the South Carolinians are, when they looked at this, they were shooting not much.
Not much.
1.2 shots per deer. But who was super high again?
Wisconsin.
Man, you guys.
Yeah.
Well, it was in the 70s.
But of course, too. Now what Doug brings
fair
up, though.
Fair point.
But it's a fair point because plus they're hunting an area where guys couldn't go in, set up tripod stands, they couldn't hang all these different things. A lot of it's probably being shot off the ground, you know, offhand. And so the conditions weren't like South Carolina had. Yeah, it's probably more like
shitty scopes.
The way us old guys used to hunt, you know,
I took a lot more shots when I was younger.
Yeah.
But then, what I did though is I looked at all these different variables and thought, really, this range from 1.2 deer per shot to over 7. So anyway,
7 shots
per deer. Yeah. And it's,
I can't understand it. I'm not calling you a liar. I just don't understand it.
Where a lot of that comes from is that, you know, you're shooting lever actions, pump shots, shotguns, that kind of stuff, semi-automatics, and they're showing too that once a guy missed a shot, well, he had follow-up shots, and like half the guys shooting at that first shot were missing the shot. So, right, and then the deer takes off and bang, 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 all of a sudden there's lead in the air. So you can see.
And then he does that 3 times, he does that 2 times and then gets a deer finally.
Yeah. And you think, well, I've been in public hunting grounds up the river here in Winona, Minnesota, back in the early 90s. And I remember thinking, every time it sounded like one of those shotguns went off, because it was a shotgun only area, it's not like they're shooting all five shots out of that semi-automatic, you know, shotgun or pump shotgun. It was constant. And so I guess I'm not that shocked by hearing that seven was the average in this one particular. It was one hunt that this went on like that.
Yeah, if you go read Yanni's buddy, Jack O'Connor. I call him Yanni O'Connor. Jack O'Connor, all those guys did was shoot.
Yeah.
They'd crawl up on a herd of something, and it'd be the you know, 20 rounds, and then they'd go up and, like, analyze the performance. First shot caught it, you know, low across the chin. Second shot, the second, third, and fourth, fifth, and sixth whiffed them.
Yeah.
My seventh shot really brought anchored it down.
Well.
So, sure.
Yeah, so what I did, though, is I averaged then. I thought, well, seven is obviously, throw that one out. One's, you know, that's the other extreme. But average is out, and you came up, my average came up to 3.45 shots per second. I mean, per deer. And so then I started calculating that. I thought, well, last gun season in Wisconsin, if you use 3.45 shots per deer, last year in Wisconsin, we were shot close to 800,000 rounds to get that number of deer we brought in last fall. And during that season that I talked about, our record season, it was up in, you know, I think 1.5 million shots. And, well, then I went and I thought, I looked at the top 10 deer states in our country in that year 2000, and I came up to, it was like 12.5 million rounds, if you're using that as your average, were being fired. So I'm working my way back to your discussion here. You and I have
it's just too staggering for me to.
It's huge, and so when we get in these discussions about wounding, I've always maintained that in my own experience, it's tougher. When I look at every deer I've killed, and I've killed over 100 of them. I think when I've shot the ones with the rifle, I didn't always know if I got them or not by the way the deer responded. Where I thought most deer I shot with the bow, I've always known if I hit them or not. I mean, I don't think I've ever been shocked, you know, that I missed one or I hit one that I thought I missed, that kind of thing.
That's a good point.
Yeah, gun hunting.
Yeah, bow hunting. You don't usually like can't tell if you.
Yeah. You typically
you might shoot and then not be clear on the quality of the.
Oh,
hit.
That's common.
Yeah.
I mean. You talk.
That's almost not quite the norm, but it's typical. Yeah. Not to be a little like, man, I don't know. It looked like it might be a little far back or yeah. a little high.
Oh, when you talk to guys that track deer with dogs, and they ask the guy, "Where'd you hit this deer?" and a typical bow hunter say, "Right here,
right in the pocket,
right in the pocket, right on the shoulder," and they find the deer and it's got you know, in the hams, you know, who knows where, you know.
Yeah.
So I've always thought that if you were to really get some research on this. What research we have, and find out what the percentages are for bull hunting versus gun hunting. I'm pretty well convinced that it's about equal.
I mean, really?
Yeah. It's in because we. But again, what the you know, I just poke holes though in my argument because all of those studies have been basically done under pretty controlled situations.
Yeah.
You know, bull hunting, the ones they've been able to study are typically control situations. It's like the one that's famous for the initial one that we often refer to is right up here at Camp Ripley, a couple hundred miles from here in Minnesota. And there they had their initial wounding, percentage of deer wounded was, I think, around 28%, 25% right in that range. But then they figured that they realized, well, just because a deer is wounded, doesn't mean it's dead. It doesn't mean it's not going to be recovered. And sure enough, they found that in that situation, there's a lot of hunters in that camp. And these are weekend hunts, I should have said, too. These are just strictly a two-day hunt, then it's done. So it's a real control situation. What they found was that their average over four, I think it's like four different hunts they studied. Only 13% of those deer were never recovered. Of those deer that were shot and hit in some location, only 13% on average weren't recovered.
What does recovered mean?
Taken home. Taken home. You know, the guy dragged that deer out of off the camp's property. Now, then there's also...
Inedible condition.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, because, you know, at Sunday at this is a Saturday and Sunday hunt that they did at Camp Ripley. Sunday afternoon, the Army basically throws you out. You can't go back and look for your deer if you don't have it. Tough luck. You know, so that's, that was the unrecovered deer was 13%. And
this was which weapon?
Bow and arrow.
And when was that?
That was back in the early 90s. And so that's one study. Then the other studies they've done, one was out in Connecticut in a suburban area. One was over in Iowa in a suburban area. And then there's like a naval weapons station out in Maryland did one not too long ago. They wrapped it up about 10 years ago. And theirs was, and one in Maryland, I think their wounding rate was, 18%, where these were deer that were hit and not recovered. Now, the one in Connecticut was about, 14%, and the one in Iowa suburbs was about 13-14%. So, and then the one with, now switching to rifle.
Now, how many of these rely on self-reporting?
Well, they all rely on self-reporting.
That's where, okay.
Yeah.
And it's just, when I said that no matter what you say, I won't.
Right.
Because I know that relies on self-reporting.
Yeah. But what they find too is self-reporting typically is that if you get the people right on the spot when they come in, most of these guys, like in these suburban hunts, these are guys that, I'm pretty sure the one in, I know the one in Connecticut was a shooting test. You had to pass a shooting test of bow and arrow to even be allowed to hunt. And I think the one in Iowa had that kind of speculation.
Above average too. Archers then.
Well, yeah. That's another factor that these are people who are dead serious bow hunters who know that taking long shots is used to increase the risk. But what I found interesting looking at that South Carolina study and with a rifle, these were dead serious riflemen. And these guys, they're sitting there with basically a little tripods in their shooting setup. They're typically shooting 150 yards and 125 yards. And they found a real split. Once you start going beyond 125 yards, even these guys who are really good, they started hitting more deer and not knowing if they hit them, losing them, that kind of thing. But every shot taken, every deer fired at in that study, they had dogs. They'd go out there and look around. And in that study, that they ended up finding out that they figured the wounding was about 15-20% wounding loss. Even with that, these really good shots shooting controlled settings, not taking these long flyers, they were still, had a 15-20% wounding loss. And a lot of those deer they never would have found if not for the dogs going out there and finding evidence of a hit that they thought they missed. Hmm. Everyone here has been in situations where you fired a shot 150 yards across a field or whatever. You walk over and you look around, you can't find any sign. And a lot of people give up, not look any further. There's no snow cover in many cases. Mm-hmm. And that's the other factor that all these moving parts is what makes a wounding loss so hard to ever really pin down for sure, is that you have so many different conditions, so many different ways that things can go wrong, that it's hard to really quantify this stuff. But what we have been able to quantify really shows pretty strikingly similar results. So that's why I say I would have a hard time being convinced that bow is wounding any more on a percentage basis than rifles.
Handful of thoughts.
Yep, go ahead.
In keeping with today's political atmosphere, I'm just going to ignore the data.
Okay.
And just go with what I know is. I'm just going to go with what I know is right. A couple things. One is, this is not a moral argument. Okay. Like, to me, I think each person strives to, well, damn sure better, strive to be as effective and humane and as efficient as possible. And I think that when you go into the woods, no matter like how high your skill set and how good your intentions, there's always the chance that something can go wrong. And it will if you stick at it long enough, and you'll hit something that you don't find. It just happens.
Totally agree.
So by saying that one is more or less one method of hunting, we could even break out crossbows and break out trad archery and break out, conventional archery tackle and break out firearms. no matter how much you break it down and start comparing them, to me, it's not like, you're not like trying to find a value judgment. You're not looking for like who's right,
right,
who's correct and
right,
who's incorrect, who's right and who's wrong. I'm not chasing after that.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it the discussion, it's an it's almost an academic subject, I think, but it can inform things. I am generally, that's one thought. Another thought is I'm generally leery of anecdotal stuff. Okay. But in a case like this, I have so much anecdotal evidence gathered over such a long period of time where I'm able to rule out the inherent errors of self-reporting, or just from experiences and the experiences of people who I'm very close with, and I understand their skill sets. You haven't changed my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that if you take something like take something like elk, okay, take something like elk. I think that there is a much higher rate of wound loss, and this is informed by personal opinion as well as the opinion of many other people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a much higher rate of wound loss on elk with archery equipment than there is with firearm equipment. It's like I just know.
Hmm.
As bad as that sounds.
Well,
and I'm not telling you what to do with that. I'm not telling anybody what to do with that piece of information, but it's a thing. It's like a debate that comes up all the time.
But here's the thing. Go ahead.
Part number three, then it's yours again. Part number three is we don't know the mortality question. Okay.
Right.
I one time found, I was out on a backpacking with llama trip in the summertime in the Idaho panhandle, and I lost my spoon and found an elk carcass or elk skeleton and was trying to figure out what bone would be most suitable to craft a new spoon out of that I could reach into a freeze-dry bag with. And I started looking at the thoracic process on the vertebra, and I thought, damn, that looks like a great spoon. So I picked up one of the vertebra to be like the one that had the longest thoracic process, so the one that's kind of like above the animal's hump. And lo and behold, embedded within the bone entirely healed around it, is a muzzy broadhead. Their slogan is bad to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
I put pictures of this up on, we'll put a picture up in the show notes. But so here's this thing growing around it. Now, the guy that shot that arrow maybe would probably be surprised to learn that that thing took the hit. Somehow the arrow shaft unthreaded, because it was just a naked broadhead, no piece of shaft on it, unthreaded. The elk healed around the broadhead, and I know that it died in the winter because it had dropped. It died with dropped antlers. So, however long it takes to calcify, like to completely encase a broadhead and calcified bone on your vertebra, that guy might think, "Oh, he might be all depressed still about that bull he killed and couldn't find when it wasn't dead." So that's the other thing is when we talk about wound loss, we're just saying like you didn't find it.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't know is what's lethal and what's not lethal. So that matters to me.
Mm-hmm. But what the story you just told, isn't that a pro bowl if you're not taking a pro and con?
No, I don't look at it as either. I'm just saying, what I'm saying is in sussing out the answer, which what I was trying to build up there, one, mm-hmm. is one, nothing you say is going to change my mind. That was point one. Two, it doesn't really matter.
I agree.
Except for just, I just like to know stuff.
Yeah,
I'm not going to like go and make like,
right.
like,
well,
if I was like ruler of the world and I had all the answers in front of me, I wouldn't like go and make a decision around it, except for in cases like, for instance, when there's some bear units in Alaska where when you wound a bear, you notch your tag. Right.
Yep.
That kind of thing I'm generally in favor of. I'm open to that and in favor of that in places.
Mm-hmm.
You wound the animal, you notch your tag. But that leads again into point three, because that's under the assumption that you've removed an animal. And what we don't know in this is it's hard to tell it's hard to tell and it's hard to study the survival rates. Yeah. So you fire an arrow, whap, you get a hit, you trail the blood, there's no blood. You start cutting circles, you come back the next day, cut a million circles, can't find blood, your buddy can't find blood, he brings out his fail-safe dog, the dog can't find anything. Is it dead or not?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the part three, is like, you still don't know even when you know.
Right, and the thing I was going to say is that I fully agree with you on the idea that this is not a moral discussion. The other thing I should have said too, I could have prefaced it with, is that we're the only predator with a conscience.
Yeah.
You know, we're the only predator that tries to make a science out of how we go about this stuff. We really try to figure out what's the best freaking way to kill that deer every damn time, you know, down dead. And because you think, well, when a hawk hits a rabbit, I've been on hawk hunts, and it's pretty fast, and they're pretty good, but they have wounding loss. Predators have wounding loss, so I will never get into this right or wrong discussion, because I think that to me is bullshit. It's part of the equation. It's just, I think hunting is, we're the only ones that worry about it as humans. So, but one of the things, I'll just say one thing real quick and then let Doug say something. Doug's waiting to go here. the thing I'd say about the story with the arrow wound, one thing that I think we can say from some of the research too, is that a deer that's wounded with a bow and arrow is much more likely to survive the wound and go on. And it might not be, it's not nice, it's not pleasant, I'm sure, to carry a broadhead around in your spinal column or in your shoulder blade or leg bones.
Jim Bridger did it.
Yeah, I mean, but humans have done it too. And so
I'm saying Jim Bridger carried an arrowhead around in his back.
I think about your dad. Your dad walked around with how many years with pellets in his
13
foot.
Shotgun pellets in his foot.
Yeah, so it happens. And I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying this stuff happens. And another story I remember from a hunt on Doug's place, first time you and I met, was Tyson having a bad shot on a deer. And it was a shot that if you made that shot with a bow and arrow, that deer would have been healed up in probably a couple of days and gone on and never looked back. Whereas it was a high hit in the back, in the meat of the back. And I remember there was hair everywhere on the impact area. And Steve...
Never a good sign.
Yeah, never a good sign. And Steve went down, went after it, and caught up with it and finished it off.
Ran it down in the woods, as I recall. Yeah.
And so I think if you look at it that way, one of the things that came out of that naval weapon station study with bow and arrow was that they figured that the deer they knew weren't recovered, that they knew they're wounded, but not recovered, was about, they figured about 6% of those went on to have normal lives and just continued on with their...
What percent?
6%. 6% of the deer that they could not recover. They knew were hit, but not recovered. And then they compared that with the deer were hit by motor vehicles on that base, and that was more like an 11% died, whereas only 6% of the bow and arrow ones died.
So, oh, hold on a minute.
Or did I
You're
reverse
saying-
that? Go ahead.
6%.
I think I might have gotten it reversed.
You got it reversed.
I think I reversed. But basically, the deer are more likely to die when they're hit by a car than they were by a bow and arrow once they're out, you know, out on their own, moving around. That it was only like 6% of the ones that were hit by a bow and arrow died, and 11% hit by cars died.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I got it right now.
Of the ones that were hit but not recovered.
Right. Other ones hit. You know, still ones that were probably definitely ones that were hit, not recovered, and died from the wound, but you know, that happens too.
Doug, what were you raising your hand about?
Man, there's so many things, and it was first one is, well, we know guns kill more, is a more effective way of killing deer than bows are. Maybe not on on an individual basis, because we kill way more deer in a much shorter time.
Way more people doing it.
Yeah, more people doing it, and greater range and more shots.
I know you're right about deer. Going on with arrows in them, because over the years I've killed at least a half a dozen with a rifle that are carrying that have got a wound from a bow or have a arrow in them or whatever. And those were, I guess those were the, there was another point, but I don't remember what it was now because you went off on another thing that was trailing. No, yeah, well, of course it was your fault. I know what it was. It's interesting to me The comparison, one of the things about bows, and you're talking about vertical bows, I think, because one of the arguments now that I'm hearing against crossbows from some vertical bow people is, oh, these guys are taking shots that they shouldn't take, and they're wounding deer, and it's sort of like the opposite argument of gun, you know, some gun hunters, and vertical bows, you know, wounding and that sort of thing. So it's just it's just interesting how all these things, to me, you know, meld together, and then you make your own choices on it. And is that
crossbow lingo now to say vertical bows?
Yeah.
It's become cross vertical. Sure, yeah.
Because we in Wisconsin we keep fighting about it, so they kind of find a way to distinguish the two. And so they're,
well, I'd say bows and crossbows.
Yeah,
vertical bows. Come on.
Doug and I,
crossbow, vertical bow, and it's a thing right now.
I just
now.
Feel that word came from the crossbow community. It didn't come from the bow community.
No, it's from a clarification. Well, I don't know either, but it's important to clarify because otherwise,
yeah, a bow,
right? But a bow versus a crossbow is a bow.
Well, that's not good on that.
Yeah.
Say that for a different podcast. Yeah. And the thing I'd say there too, though, in this naval weapon station research, they looked at crossbows too.
Oh, they did.
And it wasn't. I think they came out a little bit better on that. And one of the more fascinating parts of that study was that the expandable broadheads actually performed better than the standard injection put your blades in like
fixed
a muzzle.
Broadhead.
Fixed blade. Well, they're not totally fixed blade because fixed blade in my mind is still the ones you sharpen yourself. But replaceable blades.
Yeah, you'll break it down.
Replaceable blades.
Yeah, replaceable blades. I still like replaceable blades just because I don't like the questioning and the worrying about will that thing open the way it's supposed to. But in the study they did in Maryland, those actually came out better for more effective overall.
Expandables
did.
And I think that's one of the things that's one of the things they say about shooting a crossbow is to use a expandable blade.
Yeah, and then you get into make sure they don't fly open when they get shot down in the bow because there's such an explosion coming out of those things compared to a regular bow. But
just the air resistance.
Well, plus it's such a hard impact coming out of that 160, like you know, those are 165 pound of draw weights there. Shooting those arrows out, so, but see, like, now, and see, like, getting back to the elk point of view, that's where you and I still won't agree because I think, well, I've seen guys out in the West get these real flyers on elk, you know, hellish long ways off, and I think
you're starting to change my mind.
Damn if those guys know if they're hitting these big these are big animals. And they can, God, they can take a pounding and not even show it, you know. And, but, you know, I like the fact that at least in our modern era of hunting, that we're talking about these things and trying to figure out what's ethical, what's an ethical shot. And that one of the things I had fun, though, when I was at Deer and Deer Hunting magazine back in the 90s, we actually did a poll on this, trying to figure out from our readers, you know, what's an effective range for the bow and arrow? In your mind, what do you feel comfortable shooting at? And the thing that was always interesting was that everyone's this perfectly conscientious, ethical hunter when that deer is at less than 40 yards of the bow and arrow and less than, let's say, 200 yards of the rifle. As soon as you start putting the big antlers on them, the lead's in the air, the arrows.
Totally, man. I have the same exact problem.
Yeah, and I always think, well, you know, I brought a couple of quotes here that, where we like to think we're making progress in our approach on how we, you know, on shot selection. And, you know, Steve will probably know this one. Who wrote this? It is a good rule always to try to get as near the game as possible. At the same time, I am a great believer in powder burning. And if I cannot get near, I will generally try a shot anyhow if there's any chance of the rifle carrying it to it.
Yanni O'Connor.
Anyone want to guess?
Eldo Leopold.
Close, but not.
Well, Leopold.
I got that one,
do you know
too.
About him?
I got that one, too.
Do you know about him?
That's my next quote.
Okay.
Yanni.
Who would be left? I don't know. Elmer Keith.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt. Yeah, big believer in powder burning.
Shoot
big,
to get hot, to stay hot.
Teddy. But he was from that.
Well, he was
era of just getting the lead out.
Yeah, and the idea that, well, if you don't shoot, you certainly won't get it.
Hornaday too.
Yeah, yeah.
When you read about Hornaday's expeditions,
oh,
because when he was doing museum collecting, yeah, yeah, still he's like, he's museum collecting, but they would just kind of get where they're in the ballpark, and everybody just starts a cracking.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something to be said, I think, right now in this conversation about the sake of being, of getting close or just being 100% on your shot, not because of the ethics, but because you want to be efficient and just be a good hunter. And even though there's, like, say, giant antlers, right? But if you're a poor hunter, that's, I think, when you're like, I'm going to let some lead fly because this is my one opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think if you've achieved a certain level of hunting prowess, you will say it is too far. Either I will get closer now so that I know 100% when I shoot, I'm going to kill that thing, or I will let it walk and I will return tomorrow and, you know, change my position, my tactics or whatever to get closer. You know what I mean? I think, yeah. And there's a certain point where hunters, you know, don't just let lead fly because, you know, whatever, ethics out the window. Like you said, we're the only ones that think about that. If you're just trying to be like the best hunter out there, at some point, you're just going to say, no, I, to be successful, I can't shoot right now.
Yeah, I think there's an element of ethics. There's an element of aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an element of pragmatism. Being that I would like, yeah, if I like to think that it bothers most people that you would cripple something up and not find it. So you'd want to be eliminating that. Any self-respecting person, right, wants to be good at what they do and they put their mind to something and become good at it. A strong marker of you not being good at it is that you wound stuff and it runs off when you're supposed to be killing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then pragmatism is like, you want to get the thing. So if you're looking at, man, I could take a poke at 500 yards with my rifle. I don't know if I'll get it or not. I'm going to get to where I know I'm going to get this thing. And I know damn sure I'm going to kill it too.
But it takes a level of experience to be able to, in that moment, make that decision.
To make all those decisions. I think when people let the flyers go, when people just start blouching for no reason, is when they probably can't see their way through to getting closer. Maybe, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, another quote I wanted to share with you guys. This is from about that same era, a little bit later, but one large whitetail looked at me at 70 yards. He jumped at the flash of my bow. My arrow stuck in the ground on a second jump. If he had stood still, I would have hit him in the neck. This is written in 1927.
Aldo Leopold.
Aldo Leopold. Yeah.
70 yards.
70 yards.
He took a poke at 100 yards with his bow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's taking a poke too,
and so like
that's like trad archery.
Well, see, and see, that's the thing. I'm not taking cheap shots at these two guys because I think we had these discussions. I know Dionis and I have talked about it in Doug's backyard. I know there are guys. I know my capabilities. I know at 60 yards of bow and arrow, I start falling apart. Some days I'll be out there, I can drop them in pretty nice at 60 yards. Next day I can't. So I know that's not, for me, a realistic range. But I do know guys who can time in and time out, nail 100-yard shots with bow and arrow. But I still will always say, you're still counting on that deer to be standing there, and assuming you have a wide-open shot,
yeah.
Well, that arrow arcs, and like I don't know what it is on a compound bow today shooting a 70-pound cross compound bow, but I do know on the crossbow, I saw it the other day, where at 100 yards, a typical crossbow has to arc at 92 inches above the sight plane to drop it in at 100 yards. And I think, so these guys make all these outlandish claims about how accurate those crossbows are. I think, I don't know. I just have a hard time believing most guys using the crossbow can get those kind of shots to drop in there and learn fairly quickly. That's not realistic. Because I think Steve and I had a little conversation, just a quick question. I don't think Steve got back to me on it, but I get fascinated with elk hunting because I think when I've been elk hunting, I can see where you'd have more wounding loss than what I have gotten used to hunting deer from a tree stand. Because hunting deer from a tree stand, you're typically getting them in their tight quarters. And I think nothing, very few things I've ever killed go down faster than a a broadhead through the lungs at 20 yards. I mean, that's just deadly effective. But I think when I started elk hunting back in 2005, the bow and arrow, nothing is fixed. But, you know, you get used to that tree stand situation where you can control your shots, you can control where you're going to shoot, all those kind of things you can start controlling a little bit, at least through discipline. It doesn't happen with elk hunting. You know, it's happening fast. You're on your ground, you're at eye level, the wind changes, everything is decision-making changes fast. And I realized, this is tough shit. This is a lot harder than anything I've ever done in the whitetail woods. That's where I start thinking. Last year I killed my first elk from a tree stand, and I almost felt like cheating because it was so much easier to control that shot than it was when I was on the ground at eye level trying to pick a spot to the brush on an animal that you're waiting for it to come into a spot where you can stop it quick, get the shot off. I think.
What were you set up on?
I was on a wallow.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, early season, like the fourth day of the season, is Labor Day weekend.
National Forest.
Like National Forest, yeah. Yeah, and that just got me thinking, though, that...
What time of day did that bull show up?
I think I shot him at around 6 o'clock in the evening, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the evening.
Came in the wallow. By himself?
Yep. And he just stood there.
That's interesting.
Perfectly, not quite broadside, but he just turned a little bit, gave me a perfect, you know, right down the pipe, you know, 18 yards.
Yards. Really?
And then he jumped up, went up the hill about 40 yards, and down.
Was that wallow, when he found that wallow, was it muddied up?
A little bit, but what was interesting, this is one of the fascinating things I loved about that experience, was that he never actually made it to the wallow itself. He stopped me 15 yards uphill in this little, just muddy, little bitty seepage type stuff coming up. And he sat with his nose right down that mud. And you could just hear the of him sucking the water out. There's little bitty rivulets coming down that mountainside.
That's interesting.
And it was just fascinating as hell. And then he'd just stand there and look around, and but he's facing me the whole time. And finally, he just turned a little bit, gave me the open, you know, side shot. And I, but compared to hunting off the ground, like I said, I almost felt like, oh, God. And then I actually had guys...
Well, yeah, here's the problem, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
There is no problem. Because it might have felt easy, but look at the amount of... I mean, you did a good bit of woodsmanship to get in the situation.
Yeah, definitely.
You went out, identified an active wallow.
Make no mistake, I do not feel guilty. I mean, I say that. It felt like, oh, geez, that was so easy. But I know damn well it wasn't, because that was like 12 years in the making.
Yeah.
You know, to get that... Where actually found a spot, you could actually feel confident putting a tree stand up. And going to the trouble of putting a tree stand up on this area we hunt. It's kind of, I didn't think about it in most cases. It's just such a waste of time. Mm. You know, elk are so unpredictable. They're moving here and there. And here we found one spot.
Yeah, you put your tree stand up. And
you'll see nothing.
It's like, it's possible that there's no elk within 2 miles.
Yeah, yeah.
3 miles.
And so I just find all those kind of discussions of shot selection, how we do setups, all that kind of stuff interesting. And then you get into the thing you're talking about with air, like that bull walking around with that arrow wound. You think, well, was he really suffering the whole time or not? I mean, that thing healed over, and how much, I mean, it can't feel good. But then you read some of the research that's been done on humans and how humans react to like soldiers in battle. And there's some really fascinating research from Anzio, where your dad served, where this doctor was keeping notes on these guys that were wounded. You know, how much pain are you in? And they found a lot of cases that 70% of these guys had just awful wounds, and they barely felt it because it wasn't a shock, because he could talk to these guys, ask them, what are you feeling, doing this kind of stuff. But it was not the kind of bad pain that you'd expect. And then they learned, too, that some of these guys who were manic, who just wild with apparent pain, they could calm them down with a drug that would make them sleepy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And what they started to think and figure out was, it wasn't so much the pain that was hard on these guys. It was the anguish, the dread, that what they're like, you know, the Clint Eastwood movie, The Unforgiven, you know, a hell of a thing killing man. You're taking away all of your had and all you ever will have.
Yep.
And humans understand that. You know, they're 18 years old knowing that this is probably going to kill them, and they're just, it has to be just devastating to them. So that's where I always try to balance all stuff as I'm hunting, thinking, let's not let's not tie ourselves in knots over this. You know, we want to be good ethical hunters, but let's realize that the wilds is a tough place to live. And these animals suffer a lot of stuff that, you know, but humans do too. Humans are awful tough too. So I don't know. I find a lot of stuff fascinating.
Hmm. Pick up the tree stand thing, because you later had an interaction with someone about your tree stand elk.
Yeah. So I one of the reasons I emailed Steve was this guy writes back to me, and then he actually says to me, he tried to make me feel a little bit guilty about using a tree stand to kill an elk. And he says to me, well, what do you think Steve Rinella would think?
And I don't know. I'll ask him.
Well, but my first reaction was, well, I don't claim to know Steve as well as I know other friends in my life, but I think Rinella strikes me as a practical guy that if you put your time in and you find a good spot and you want to hunt it that way, go for it. Yeah.
Dude, my brother he's got an idea of the hunt purity score. Okay. So it allows you to have many to factor in many different variables.
Yeah.
Just to then arrive at a fixed score. And you can have 20 inputs and do a hunt purity score. So when I run your situation through my personal hunt purity score calculator.
Yeah.
Unguided. Okay. Right. So you're just out there, dude out there on his own.
Yep.
Not relying on a guide. Because you could have a guide like, oh yeah, I killed it. We bugled a bull in and shot him, but the guide did everything. And he probably would have shot the thing better than you did too. You were, if anything, you were a hindrance on the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
You were the trigger man.
Yeah.
So that's not the case. Okay. Not that you can't still, you could have a guide and still score a great hunt purity score as you put in all the factors that go into a hunt purity score. Right, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's like just one of. What's your problem? Why are you giving me the Latvian smirk?
No, I'm just enjoying this. Oh. The hunt purity score, if there was such a thing.
So,
an app.
Each to his own. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I'm running Pat Durkin's, when I'm giving a hunt purity score to Pat Durkin's tree stand elk, this is what I'm thinking about. Self guided.
Mm-hmm.
Public land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, public land. Not that you can't have a great hunt purity score on private land. Done a lot of it myself, but in the hunt purity score calculator, that score is high because here you are dealing with a lot of competition, things outside of your control. So mm-hmm. it's like an added difficulty, right? A little bit of woodsmanship. There's a lot of wallows out there. There are more wallows out there that are not going to be visited by a bull tonight than there are wallows. What the hell are you smirking about, Doug?
Man, I just feel like I need to keep my face down. And not
listen, there are more wallows. There are more wallows in the woods that, what was the date you killed this bull? September.
September 4th.
Okay. There are more, September 4th. Go to the state Pat was in and go have a monitor, get a volunteer to sit on every single wallow in that state. And more than there's going to be more people whose wallow doesn't get hit by an elk that night than does.
Definitely.
So he had to pick a good, pick the right wallow.
Here he is, self-guided, in a place you hunted a little bit,
mm-hmm.
finds a wallow, determines that this is where I'm going to stake my claim. Presumably, you had to tote that tree stand through a lot of uncomfortable toting areas.
On a hot day.
On a hot day. So there's your hunt purity score climbs up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had to pick where you're going to hang this stand. Factoring in wind, not just wind, but how the wind is going to change as the thermal shift, as the air starts to cool, as the sun begins to set. Mm-hmm. So Pat's running all this shit in his head as his hunt purity score climbs. Like, I just, like, nowhere in it, there's nowhere in it where I'm looking, I'm like, man, that's a real shrinker. A real hunt purity score shrinker.
Yeah.
The bow and arrow gives it a higher hunt purity score. In my personal estimation, that gives it a higher hunt purity score than if it were a firearm.
If you use a trad bow versus a
higher hunt purity score.
I can say so.
When done, yeah.
If you made your own arrows and napped your own heads,
higher hunt purity score. Many things go into a hunt purity. You could make your own bow, make your own string, make your own arrow shafts, nap your own head.
Make your own hunting clothes.
Find a roadkill turkey, make your own fletching, and still have a real low hunt purity score depending on the other inputs. So that in and of itself, right? But like the hunt you're describing to me is very pure.
Yeah.
I like the sounds of it.
Thank you.
So,
and we packed it ourselves.
It was a great story to read too. I really enjoyed those columns about it. Yeah, it was great.
And you kept your nerves.
Oh, definitely.
Because you know what? Oftentimes, when something's coming in, you don't get calmer.
No, not especially not with the elk.
Sometimes it's almost beneficial to have something happen fast.
Yeah, and this one actually played out over about 5 minutes, where he came in. I thought I was going to nail him right away, and then he came in. Came right to me straight on. Just when I'm right there to shoot, he turns and walks right straight at me. And then I had to let down twice. And it's just a fun experience.
Mm. You know, another thing I factor in? A lot of people probably don't, but I do. Whether it was aware of you or not.
Yeah, he had no idea I was there.
That counts a lot in my personal hunt purity calculator.
Yeah.
Setup, I'm interested about the tree stand setup relative to the wall of downhill, because you're playing a downhill thermal.
No. You know, I looked into everything around me to figure out where I could put up a stand and have a decent chance. And I ended up having to go uphill from that wallow. And knowing that as the thermals start dropping, if anything's coming down from below, I'm not going to have a chance.
Yeah.
You know, it'll just be going down. And that was my fear, is that, you know, if they come from downhill where I think they're going to come from, most likely, or all I could hope was it going to be up on the side hill more or across the way more and filter through that area. But the thing is, too, I sometimes when I'm hunting whitetails, too, some of those situations, you can't always predict where they're going to come from. You think you can, but then, and in this case, the bull came exactly from where I did not expect him.
Hmm.
He was uphill from me, and I heard a twig snap, and then I look up, and here's this bull. Oh, shit, there's a bull.
Yeah.
And I haven't had buck fever like that in a long time. Where even though I've been elk hunting a lot and had a lot of encounters, that one just really had me jacked up. And then by the time I got where I could shoot, though, I wasn't calm. I mean, the heart's still hammering. But it was – I will always make a point, like at trade shows, if I see – like I've seen – like Tiffany Lukowski makes some hella good shots on deer, caribou, and elk. And I walked up to her one time and I said, you know, I know you take a lot of shit from people because, you know, she's a pretty girl, blonde girl. I think sometimes she comes across ditzy to some people. But you watch some of the shots that girl's made on TV, and I think that girl's got some blood, some real ice in her veins, because I've seen guys blow those kind of shots.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I respect that, because I think to pull off a shot like that, especially with a camera over your back, and knowing what's on you know, basically what's at stake here, and you're on, make a big investment on a hunt like that, and the time involved, then you pull it off. I think that's commendable. I respect that, because I know I've blown those kind of shots. I mean, who hasn't? And so anyway, like when I made that shot that night, and that bull piled up, you know, like, you know, 40 yards away. I watched the whole thing. Damn, I felt good.
Yeah.
And those kind of moments just, you know, I think that's why we're out here. And that's why I said I make the comment that I felt a little guilty because it seemed so easy. But I think, yeah, it's not really guilty. It's just that, you know.
It's not really easy.
You know better. You know how hard it is to get those shots and get those situations to work out and how many situations don't work out.
Oh, yeah, when you're out there just getting ground down by the situations that don't work out, when something does work really good, it's almost like you feel like you've stepped into, like you've walked into a hallucination.
Yeah.
That you're hallucinating that it worked.
Yeah.
It's that surprising.
Yeah.
I mean, you mean like I actually just got close to that elk and ran an arrow through its lungs and it fell over dead? It's more plausible that I'm hallucinating right now than that just happened.
Yeah.
We've been talking about thermals. I want to explain it real, because I feel like some people might not get what we're talking about. So when you're thermals happen when you're in a, I mean, you can have thermals without topography, but I think you kind of bank on in mountainous country is that, you know, warm air rises. So I'm not telling you this, Pat. I'm just telling Joe Blow out there. Warm air rises. So in the morning when the sun starts to come up and the day starts to heat up, you're generally going to wind up having uphill winds. And then in the evening, as the sun sets and the air cools, you're going to have, you know, it's going to switch. Sometimes we would get set up where we're going to do a stalk on an animal and you'll just sit around and wait depending on where it is and how, the best approach, you'll sit around and wait for when the thermal shift. Because you'll know that at some point today, I know that like at whatever time, you know, whatever time it happened the night before or whenever the evening sets on, that the wind's going to shift possibly to the point that it overrides the normal predominant wind direction. But sometimes you can just have like so much wind, if there's a weather pattern moving through or whatever, you can have so much wind that that sort of natural wind, not natural, that's not the right word for it, but just that that general wind direction conspires with the thermals to just make swirling air, which is very frustrating when it's not up or down. It's just everywhere.
Yeah. We lived and died by the thermals when I got it in Colorado, and a particular spot, which is kind of a good example of the morning hunt. Because in the morning, too, usually you have a downhill thermal, you know, just because it's like, you know, how it's like the coldest right at sunrise or whatever.
Oh, I mean, right at 30, daybreak.
30 minutes before sunrise. It's, you know, coldest part maybe. So you got that downhill thermal. But we had this knob that you could kind of sit on, and it was, I don't know, at least 1,000 feet down to this hayfield, and these elk would be out in this hayfield, you know, and we actually couldn't hunt out there. So, which is one of the reasons we hadn't just, you know, gone and ambushed them down there, but they would be coming towards us, you know, as it got light and coming up onto that hill, but thermal's like right at your back. So you'd have to sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait. And they'd be screaming and ripping. And you're just like sitting there with your puffer, just watching it and just hoping for the day to warm up before they quit bugling. And so many times, I mean, you'd wait sometimes till 8:30, 9. I mean, you've been sitting up there for 2+ hours. And then finally, you just like, you start feeling that constant, you know, uphill thermal. And we would just bail off that hill, you know, try not to break a leg as we ran down in there, you know, and then we'd start calling. But yeah, you mentioned the some places have so much wind that when I went to the guide in North Park for a year, it's just a windy part of Colorado, like up there by Walden. And I remember like halfway through the elk season being like, I seriously haven't used my wind checker or thought about a thermal for a month because it was just constant. Like every day you're just like, oh, the wind's out of the east. It's going to be out of the east all day. You know, we never thought about thermals there.
I'll tell you another good thermals trick is a creek. Well, all, you know, a creek will in the daytime cool the air above it. And you could have a wind direction going some direction or another. You drop down into a creek bed, and you'll find that it's a downwind, that there's a strong downwind current created by that water. And you can creep up creek beds or streams that are flowing and be the whole time in nose hitting you, like wind hitting you in the face as you go upstream, even though the wind is different 100 yards up the hill.
I was once creeping up a creek on the north side of it, in the timber, probably a foot to 18 inches of snow, powdery snow, silent as can be, and I'm probably 50 yards above the bottom of the creek. And we're trying to catch up these elk that are feeding in the Quakies on the south-facing slope, pretty narrow canyon. And we're working our way up it. We get to the elk. We get all the way so we're exactly, you know, parallel to them. And I'm feeling the wind. We got just a nice downhill thermal. And we're just like, there's no clear shots, but there's like 20 cows up there. And we're just waiting for a good shot. And all of a sudden, I see a couple noses pop up. You know, I'm like, what? There's no way. You know, I'm like, it is like we're freezing here. I can just feel it going down towards the creek. And eventually they bust. 3 hours later, I think we killed a cow. But I think what actually happened is that the thermal came down, pushed our scent to the creek bottom. And then instead of just keeping flowing down the creek, it must have just gotten onto that warm hillside that the sun was hitting, the south facing slope.
And that carried it up.
And it carried it up right to him.
Wow.
So, I mean, you will get.
Yeah, you will sometimes have stuff whiff you where you just can't understand how it whiffed you.
Yeah.
And it's, stuff like that probably. And it even argues. Where I'll be like, who moved? Who moved? Someone moved. They moved. Well, you know, then it wouldn't have spooked.
I've seen it done where, like, Bob Folkrod used to do these demonstrations with air currents where he'd use a smoke bomb you know, to show how the wind, you think it's going this way. And like, well, it goes that way for a while, and then it just starts moving off again. So hard to play that stuff.
Pat, tell me why the old-time traditional deer camps are disappearing.
That's been one that I've, you know, being the sentimental sap I am, I always think that's how how deer hunting should be, where you pull into a camp for basically the whole 9-day season like they used to do. You know, in Wisconsin, they used to take trains up north. And what's happened is that we made travel, I think, a big factor. There's many factors, of course, but one of the big factors is that travel is so convenient. You can now hop in your car anywhere in Wisconsin, basically be up north in 5 hours, and then you can be back home Sunday evening really easily. It's not a big trip anymore. Even when I was a kid in the 70s going deer hunting, only highways going north in Wisconsin were all 2-lane highways. And so the trip up north was it was kind of an endurance thing. You just kind of ride along in those 2-lane highways, mm-hmm. waiting to pass people all the time. And it was just, so when you got up there, you're in no hurry to come back. You want to stay up there a while. And you think, well, if that's how it was in the 70s, can you imagine what it was like back in the 40s and 50s, where guys would have to drive up there and not always be able to even get down the road to their camp? You know, they'd have to get the neighbor to get a tractor and take them down and haul them in. And so I think that's a big factor that, you know, in our society we have now with a great transportation, really reliable vehicles, people just don't have to go in and spend that kind of time in the camp. And then you have the other factors going on in recent decades is that, well, the old guys, it was worth going up north in northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, and northern Minnesota because there's good deer hunting. Well, it's gotten tougher. You know, the forest matured, and we have all these factors like that where you're not seeing as many deer.
And yeah, well, look at the case of our very own Doug Dern.
Exactly.
Yep. Doug, when correct me if I'm wrong, Doug.
You can speak.
Doug was a boy. His old man went to northern deer camp.
That's right.
Yeah.
Around the farm, if you saw a deer, you talked about it.
Yeah. That's right.
You're like, holy shit, we saw a deer.
Yeah.
And everyone for deer season drove up. Now, you got how many deer per square whatever?
More than 75 yeah. per square mile of habitat.
And what's the stocking or the ratio of deer per unit of land in the North Woods?
Much lower.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
so the deer came to you. You don't need to go to the deer.
I'm a deer magnet.
Well, last time you guys were down at Doug's in 2015, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
Gun season. I killed a nice buck that year down about 10 miles from Doug's place on my uncle's farm. And the only reason I'm telling that is because when I drove over to the taxidermist to get the lymph nodes taken out for the CWD testing, I missed the turn, couldn't find the place, and I stopped a hunter on the road who was just getting ready to walk down into this field. Got talking to him. Well, he's from Hayward, Wisconsin, which is way up north. And the reason he's down in Doug's backyard, basically, is because the deer hunting up in Hayward sucks.
He's driving south to deer
camp. He drove all the way. Yeah,
complete reversal.
To hunt a public piece of property over in the Bear Valley area.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what's happened, you know, between the switch in the habitat where the habitat down in southern Wisconsin favors a deer more than up north. And you have, it's you know, the guys who still hunt up there, they typically aren't going in for 5 days, Thanksgiving. It used to be a real thing where you'd go up there and you'd arrive on Friday before gun season, set up camp, and you wouldn't come back till the following weekend or Sunday night.
And people were logging the Northwoods back then.
Much more logging back then. Now the logging isn't keeping up with the forest maturation. So the forests keep getting older and older and older and less deer habitat. And so I'm never surprised.
Less grouse habitat, less woodcock habitat.
Yeah, all those things factor in. If deer are thriving, grouse are usually thriving, you know, and those areas are just tougher now. So I think those two factors, I think, are probably the biggest reasons. And plus, I think there's just a lot of people just don't like having a faraway camp to take care of. You know, it's a lot of maintenance on any kind of building. Once you put a building on a land 300 miles away, you got to be up there a lot taking care of it. And I think people like my generation, at least me, I don't like care to be taking care of stuff all the time. Hmm. I'd rather just, you know, show up someplace and I'd rather sleep out of the back of my truck than maintain a shack year round, you know, for deer hunting.
Yeah.
And that's just the way I am.
Well, and hunting's changed too. I mean, you know, the increase in bow hunting and, you know, up north, down by us, whatever. And there's always that talk about the loss of loss of deer hunters, fewer deer licenses being sold, but yet there's an increase in bow licenses, so it's just changing.
Mm-hmm.
And the style of hunting's changing. And
yeah, there's no, so. Well, you don't do the community deer drives like we used to do, and that used to be a big thing up north. used to drive along those rural roads in northern Wisconsin, see lines of people lined up waiting to go in and do a big push. And we just don't hunt that way much anymore.
But you lament it.
Oh, I do, just because I think it was a cool time. And I still do a series going on almost 10 years now where I travel around to different parts of the country and visit deer camps. Because I think, I'd like to document it while it's still around. You know, whether it's northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, I'd go down south to visit some of their deer camps, because even down there it's not that easy to maintain those traditions for a long time. To go generation after generation and maintain that hunting interest. I just use my own family as an example. I think, well, my dad hunted a little bit just to get me going, but he dropped out, about the time I was coming along, where he really wasn't active hunting anymore. But out of me and my three brothers, I'm the only one that hunts. And I think a lot of people in our generation just don't have the interest. And I look at our hunter demographics, and that's not looking all that great for the future. So you think that's a part of Americana that's kind of slipping away on us.
In some areas. Yeah.
I think in
the Midwest, the old idea that you had these sort of unsettled wild lands in the North, like we grew up in just like a thing you heard all the time, up north. Like everyone went, like in Michigan, you didn't do any cross movement. You didn't know like east-west movement. Yeah. All movement was north-south.
Yeah.
He's like, drove that direction. If you wanted to get into something, you drove north if you wanted to get into something good. You drove south to get back home. Eyes were always to the north.
Yeah.
And the first time when I left home, I went north, whatever, 100 miles, hundreds of miles, and set up shop up there.
Yeah.
One last question for you. Mm-hmm. You were putting to me, is it socially acceptable, morally acceptable to schedule a wedding on opening weekend of deer season?
Yeah, and my take, being the Wisconsin chauvinist I am, and knowing that Wisconsin deer hunting, the deer season, everyone knows when deer season is in Wisconsin. And if you don't know, you really I have to wonder about you. How can you not be
living
aware
in a bubble?
Yeah, this is a big thing in Wisconsin. You cannot miss all the blaze orange going usually north, even though people are going east and west too. But you cannot miss all the blaze orange in the road before our gun season opens. And then think just at work, how many people you get around at work who are talking about deer hunting? Husbands going deer hunting, girlfriends going with their boyfriends, that kind of stuff. And so I think when you know this is a once-a-year event. Pretty much most people have, in Wisconsin anyway, my friend Tom Heberlein always had the comment in his research on hunters in Wisconsin that in Wisconsin, you either are a deer hunter or you're sleeping with a deer hunter. Because, and he didn't mean just in one bed, but he meant throughout the household. There's always someone in the house who hunts. So I think having all that awareness of deer hunting, especially our gun season, how can you possibly justify having a wedding opening week in a gun season? You know you're going to affect the lives of a lot of people who are either going to skip your wedding or be really resentful that you dragged them out of the woods for your wedding that you could have scheduled 51 other weekends. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
And
there's a reason I got married in mid July.
Yeah. I think personally that's respectful of other people's time.
And I haven't screwed up. I haven't yet screwed up majorly on children's birth dates. I got one May 9 in there that is difficult. It's difficult.
Mm-hmm. But none of them were by planning.
That one, we were pretty much planning out. And I'm like, at least it wasn't the fall. I got a May 9 in there, and his mother likes him to be around home on his birthday. His mother doesn't want him to be off doing whatever. I want to be there. It wasn't great. It wasn't great, but it wasn't horrible.
There might come a time, though, where he gets to make that decision to say, you know what? I'd really like to be out at Uncle Doug's turkey hunt on my birthday.
Listen,
can we go?
I had
please?
That conversation this year. We were going to go turkey hunting, but it's like in my family, this didn't come from me. and my family and the powers that be within that family, there seems to be this thing where everyone's all together on birthdays.
Yeah, because I know.
So it's like the calendar starts to get really crowded. Hold your thought, Doug. The calendar starts to get really crowded when you have, like I do, I have three kids. So there's three. You only got 365 days out of the year. There's three of them. You get a spouse birthday, an anniversary, handful of religious holidays. It's like if I could do it all over again, I'd just gotten married on Christmas. And then
married a girl who's born on Christmas.
Find a girl, yeah. Find a girl's like birthdays around Christmas, get married on Christmas, and then try to impregnate her routinely 9 months prior. Before Christmas. Doug, you have a family story about this.
I have three things that come to mind about it. One, my Uncle Ralph Zielinski, who was one of my dad's hunting buddies up north when they used to go up north, and the guy who I first heard the word mooching from, got married on opening weekend. My dad never forgave him. Ralph is now 93 years old. My dad's dead. My dad went to his grave still pissed off about that.
Why? Why did he get married on opening weekend?
I think it was a power thing. I shouldn't say it because they're both still alive and they might listen to this. I don't know. I don't know why. What the hell? That's all my dad's. What the hell's the matter with him? That's all my dad said. Last year, my nephew, Sam, who you all know, has, and I'm happy to say his name, had a new girlfriend. They'd been going out for about 3 or 4 months. And he calls me up about 3 weeks before opening weekend. He goes, "Hey, Uncle Doug, I'm not going to be there opening weekend." And I said, "Why not?" He goes, "Well, Kara's family has a wedding out in New Jersey, and I said I'd go along, and I didn't realize it was opening weekend, but now I committed to it, so I got to go." I said, "Kid, there's two things wrong with that. First one is, chances are, a year from now, she's not going to be your girlfriend.
Yeah.
So you just gave up an opening weekend for somebody you're no longer with. Or you are still together. You get married.
And you set an awful precedent.
Awful precedent.
I've seen a lot of guys really screw themselves in the courtship phase by giving up liberties that they think they're going to somehow get back later.
Yeah.
You need to.
Yeah.
I tell people, I don't care if you need to drive down the road and sleep in a car. Act like you have shit to do. When you start dating someone.
Yeah.
Just to set the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you haven't told the story I want you to tell.
Which one was that?
About, didn't your old man?
Oh, my brother. So my mom's my mom is pregnant, and the due date, and there wasn't a whole lot of planning from what I could tell when we were conceived. And my dad was just a, you know, he loved going up north and deer hunting. And as it happened, my brother is due like right at the end of, you know, that third week in November. And my father started telling my mom, "You better have that kid." November 2nd. He was born November 2nd. 2 weeks later, dad's going north.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Well,
good for him.
One of my old newspaper buddies back in this is the early 80s, Penny and I started our family. Our firstborn Leah was born in January of 85, and so we planned it. You know, we made sure that we didn't start all the stuff until we had, you know. And Penny got pregnant right away, so it was January for Leah. Ellie came along in July. The only one we came close to missing on was Carson, our youngest, and she was born right before, she's born September 12th.
Ooh,
and this, yeah, and this is before I was
elk
hunting.
Oh.
And so this is.
You're still Eastern Whitetail hunting.
I was still Eastern Whitetail hunting.
So you thought September was a great month. You thought it was really a hot, boring month.
I thought, we slid into home on that one. You know, just really, it was close. But I was telling some guys at work that, you know, I can't remember how we got talking about, because none of these guys were hunters. But when I mentioned the fact that Penny and I planned, and she wasn't like I was holding a gun to her head. We just talked about, in practical terms, when do you want these kids to arrive, and when we kind of for my schedule, it worked out better that if you want me home to help with the kids, it's better if it's outside the hunting
season. Yeah, wind a calendar and some lovemaking.
Yeah. So I remember this one guy saying, people like you make me ashamed of the male species, you know.
God, I couldn't be prouder of you.
And I thought, well, hey, if my wife understands, this all matters to me. Yeah. I don't give a shit with this guy. Yeah. You know, I thought.
No, I know I missed the mark a little bit on a May Niner because of spring bear and turkey. Mm-hmm. But when you factor in, I also got a mid-December and I got a late January. So,
yeah.
And the late January, which is the best one I got, was accidental. So it's like, even when I'm making mistakes, I'm hitting the right target. Yeah. But what do you got, Yanni?
Yeah. Well, I'm not really throwing him under the bus, but I missed our now good friend Brody's wedding because it was a September wedding. I can't remember exactly when, but my wife had to go with a friend of mine.
You sent your wife to your buddy's wedding?
I was elk hunting. It was September.
And Brody understood, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
What the hell was Brody getting married then for?
I don't know.
I'm assuming Brody's listening.
Yeah, Brody. He will be.
No, but what are your for throwing offspring? What'd you hit?
Oh, August 7th, nice. And December 5th. So yeah, both.
Yeah, good. Perfect. Good shooting.
Nice. December 15th for me. So yeah,
just one, right in the perfect spot.
Yeah, I can't say that that was planned. That was dumb luck.
But you start to realize that the odds are it's going to be okay because there's more months when it's okay to have a kid than there are when it's not okay to have a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's plenty of room that it figure things out without really causing hard feelings.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like
you're asking the impossible.
Yeah. You know, it's just, to me, it's just being reasonable and realistic. And because like when we got married, it was December 6th. You know, I just saw the Navy, and Penny's mom made it clear that she's not moving to Wisconsin with me unless she's married. And so I looked at my schedule and thought, well, deer season's, you know, this. Well, how about 2 weeks after deer season? So that's what we did.
Yeah.
All right, Dougie. Concluders?
I was fascinated by the wallow conversation, and you giving Pat so much credit about
I was pumping them up.
Pumping that wallow, finding that wallow, all the woodsmanship that goes along with, you know, all these various places where it might be.
Purity pouring in.
And it just reminded me so much of being able to figure out where turkeys roost and hijacking them on the way there.
Nice. Takes good woodsmanship to find out where a turkey's roost and to find out a turkey's roost and then bushwhack him on his way in there. Pat, concluders?
Yeah, my concluder is that I know you guys like history, and when I realized we're going to be meeting in La Crosse, it made me think of an old lieutenant named, he never lived an old age. I think he died at age 34 in the War of 1812. His name was, you probably know of, Zebulon Pike.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Pike's Peak.
Well, yeah. Did you know there's
the great Western explorer.
Did you know there's two Pike's Peak?
Nope.
There's one just down the road here, just down the river here at in Iowa. Is that way?
Yeah.
Yeah. You go down to Iowa, 500 feet above, right across from Prairie du Chien, and Prairie du Chien is where the Wisconsin River meets the Mississippi River. Right across from there is a 500-foot bluff, and he named that one Pike's Peak, too. That was the first one he named.
Really?
Yeah. And yep. Then
the guy had kind of like a phallic sort of hang-up.
Yeah, he was, well, in just about 15 years ago, they had like, I think it was a centennial over Minnesota, and this guy referred to Zebulon Pike as, he said something like, it's 200 years since this exploration he made up the Mississippi, and he's still not Lewis and Clark. He's still basically, no respect for the guy. And one of the reasons that they don't respect him to this day is because he was, one of his missions from President Jefferson was to find the headwaters of the Mississippi. So he went up into central Minnesota, north central Minnesota, and decided that Leech Lake was the headwaters of the Mississippi. Well, of course, time went on, and they realized, no, it's actually to the west a little ways, and it's actually Lake Itasca. So he blew that. But while he's up there, he set his soldiers to work on dugout canoes because they had to keep exploring. So he's had them make these dugout canoes. And they're all wondering, why the hell would you make your men make dugout canoes when you have, we're among the Chippewa people, the Ojibwe, and they're famous for these birch bark canoes. But this guy insisted on his dugouts. Well, they sank very quickly. They sank with all his powder. And Zebulon Pike decided, well, let's dry the powder out. So he had the guy spread this gunpowder over all this, probably canvas or whatever cloth they had in those days. And then they set it high enough above a fire they thought was safe. Well, it burned his tents up. So those tents burn up. He's ruined everything. And this kind of reputation, these kind of things he did, the things he was famous for, these real screw-ups, but at the same time, he had some respect because he was a tough survivor-type guy. He'd be sick, and he worked through sicknesses. But his place in history, the people who studied him kind of referred to him as the B-team of Lewis and Clark, that he was not in their league.
See, I didn't know this about. Yeah. I didn't know that Pike was kind of, like, not slick.
Yeah, and he went... Jefferson, then after this exploration up in this part of the world, Jefferson sent him to explore the southern regions of the Louisiana Purchase, you know, because Lewis and Clark were up doing one in the Northwest. And he went down in the Colorado area, and he got to Pike's Peak, what the mountain he named Pike's Peak, out there, and he decided he was going to try to scale Pike's Peak. Well, it got to be pretty cold, and they gave up that idea, and he had decided that this mountain can't be climbed. So they gave up on the idea. Then he started pushing southward. I think then his message or his mission was to find the Red River or someplace down there.
Okay.
Well, he got his troops all lost. They eventually got captured by the Spanish army, and then apparently his people, his men were thankful that they'd been captured because they finally had somebody in charge that knew what was going on.
We're not lost anymore.
Yeah. So then eventually they let him go back. You know, but he ended up dying not that long after that. He fought in the War of 1812, and when they're invading Toronto, he got killed in Toronto at age 34. But yeah,
Pike died at 34.
Age 34. Yeah.
Jeez, I think Custer was 36 when he died.
Yeah.
I used to weigh life as like, when I hit 36, and I was like, well, Custer died now.
Yeah.
That's a way to, it's a, you take stock when you hear people dying.
Yeah, Mozart died at 37.
Did he?
Yeah. So you think?
Zebulon Pike died at 30?
34. He was a general by that time, but he was, you know, yeah, he was dead at 34.
God, makes me feel like a do-nothing. And he sucked at everything, it sounds like.
Well,
but he had a good publicist, apparently.
Yeah, name big mountains. Hey, man, you know the story about Laramie? Okay, so Laramie's a guy, like, he's a mountain man, not even. Shows up out west, hoping to be a mountain man, quickly gets killed under, depending on who you ask how he got killed, he might have got killed by some Indians and stuffed down a hole in the ice in a beaver pond. There's different versions of events, but total greenhorn, shows up on the scene, very quickly is dead, murdered, killed in action, mountain man action, winds up with a town, a mountain range, a peak, a river, and on and on and on.
Any idea of how he got that kind of, why they picked his name out?
I'm guessing it was like, because whatever beaver pond he got stuffed down through the ice in became Laramie River.
Yeah.
And then just people...
And the name just rolls off your tongue.
It is a pretty name, yeah.
Now, Bridger, there's a guy that deserves it and got everything named after him.
Yeah. So that's my story from this part of the world, you know, from Zebulon Pike's search up here.
Yeah, the moral of the story is look for the highest thing you can see around and name it after yourself.
Yep. So there are two Pike's Peaks.
Now, yeah, I didn't know about the Wisconsin one.
Yeah, well, it's actually Iowa.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's right across the river from Prairie du Chien.
Laramie Peak.
No.
I'm sorry.
Pike's Peak.
Pike's Peak, Iowa.
Yep.
I'm going to climb that one.
Yep, 500 feet.
You can drive right to the top of it.
Yeah. Is it 500 feet?
And we drove. Yeah, it's 500 feet, so it's like, what's that? 14 divided by 1,400 do I have? By 5. You know,
I can't do that kind of math.
I was screwed up, so that's...
It's somewhere south of 500.
It is a cool spot, though.
Yeah, it's 1/28th the height of Pike's Peak. But yeah, that's our Pike story.
So he was like, he's like, dude, next time I name a mountain.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it like this.
Well, he also apparently picked that spot, Pike's Peak, for an army fort. He suggested the army, they build a fort there. Well, then the army engineers came through years later, looked things over and said, no, Prairie du Chien will do just fine. They aren't building it up on the mountain. They're up on the bluff. They're building it down in that with a confluence of the Wisconsin River and Mississippi River.
So they could command the rivers.
Yeah.
And not to carry their stuff right. So far.
Yeah. So he wasn't good at citing forts either.
His long list of things He wasn't that good at. All right, Doug Dern. No, I know you got, yeah. I'm just saying your name. I like to end things by saying names like that.
Doug Thanks Dern. For having me. Nice being here.
Yeah, if it was the beginning, I'd be like, Doug Dern. But at the end, I'm like,
Doug Dern.
Doug Dern. And Patrick Durkin. What's your middle name, Pat?
Edward.
P-D, P-E-D.
P-E-D.
Okay.
Did you have any closing thoughts today?
No.
Don't have any.
Nothing.
Yep.
I'm spent.
All right.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Doug.
Well, thanks for having us.